I want you to open your Bibles to Matthew 15. Got to be honest with you, I've never preached inside a gate before. This is sort of an historic moment for me. It's also a lot of fun. A couple years ago, my secretary buzzed me and she said, Dr. Hemphill from Southwestern Seminary is on the phone. Of course, my first thought is, what friend is calling with the gag? So I answer the phone, that's Dr. Hemphill, and he said, we want you to come preach in chapel. So my next thought is, and before he said that, really my second thought was, they found out I really hadn't read all those books I said I did, but then he said, we want you to come preach in chapel. And so my next thought is, my goodness, this is unbelievable. I mean, I'm going to get to be a chapel speaker, which is like the height of greatness. And immediately I'm thinking, you know, I'm probably going to be Adrian's successor, I'm sure now. And so then Dr. Hemphill said, and I promise you this is exactly how the conversation went, Dr. Hemphill said, now Chris, the guy you'll be replacing is, and he said, you're preaching in 2 weeks, and the reason we're asking you is we knew we wouldn't have to fly you, we knew you could just drive straight up. So immediately, instead of being Adrian Rogers' successor, you now go to Danny DeVito with a Bible. So pretty much, it was an alteration in my life. Now the second reason I'm really excited about being here, it's historical for me because I got to be honest here, it's confession time. I went to Mississippi College. Now, at MC, we had chapel 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and you had to go 5 out of your 8 semesters. So when I got to Southwestern Seminary, chapel was just not a deal for me. Now, I preached 2 years ago at Southwestern, last year at New Orleans, this year at Southeastern. So I have now preached in more chapels than I attended when I was at Southwestern Seminary. So it's an historical moment. I hate to admit that, but you just got to be honest. Now, I want you to listen in Matthew 15, beginning in verse 21. This is, to me, the essence of life verse, if you have a call. Now, let me tell you, I'm really tired of a couple things. Number one, I am Jabez'd out. I'm sorry. When I saw Jabez for children, I just did it for me. I'm out. I'm Jabez'd. I prayed it every day. My dear lease has not been enlarged. It is still the same size. So, I'm Jabez'd out. Secondly, I am really weary of all the gimmicks that are out there. Now, you can go to all sorts of church growth movements, and they will tell you everything to do. That you need to be creative. You need to have drama. You need to have screens. You need to make sure you do praise courses. They have everything outlined for you. And some of those things are great, and we do them at Central. We do drama. We do screens. As a matter of fact, I can tell you about our screens. My music guy, of course, only music guys do this. My music guy had a fundraiser for hymnals for 6 months. The Sunday, we put the brand new hymnals in the back of the pews. We started the screens. So we've never opened the hymnals, but they're paid for. So we do all that stuff, and I'm telling you, bottom line, it is not what determines your success in ministry. Now, I really do believe with every fiber of my heart what determines it is in this passage before us. And that is that God calls you. Now, what you have to do is put yourself in a position where He can enact that call. That is not a guarantee. You have to do something for Him to enact that call. And that is not being creative. It is not being clever. It is not doing all the gimmicks. But it is doing one thing. It's not even being available. Now, I want you to listen carefully because this is an odd scripture. It is an aberration for what we normally would preach about Jesus. But I really think it's one of the greatest insights as to what God's going to do with you. Now, I hate alliteration, but let me just tell you, there is a request, there is a response, there is a result. I'm not a literary guy. I'm telling you, I hate that stuff, but that's what's here. I got to live with it. Listen carefully. I never do that because everybody's trying to figure out what the third R is. Let's see, respond. Listen. Then Jesus went out from there, and he departed to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region, and she cried out to him, saying, now I want you to listen to her request. I want you to walk through it with me. Listen, number one, have mercy on me. Now, number one, what she does is she comes to him, and she says, Jesus, I don't deserve what I'm asking for. I want you to just have mercy on me. I'm not coming because I think you owe me anything. I'm coming because I really do believe you have got to give me mercy. Number two, she says, oh Lord, Son of David. Now, we don't know where she got this, but her, and we will use this because we're in seminary, her Christology, or if you're a real person, her understanding of Christ is Very precise here. She knows who he is in his deity. She calls him Lord. She knows who he is in his humanity. He's the one that ought to be on the throne. Now understand, where she got that I do not know. I do know that Jesus Christ looked at Simon Peter and said, "Blessed are you, flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven." So somewhere God spoke to her and taught her certain truths. How he did it, where he did it, I do not know, doesn't matter. She has them. Now I know some of you budding Greek scholars that have had one semester of Greek are going to say to me, "Well, yeah, but curious can mean sir as well as Lord." Except we get down to verse 25 and it says she worshipped him. You don't worship sirs, you only worship God. So that's not the way she means this. When she says Lord, she means, I know who you are in your deity. I know who you are in your humanity. Then she says, my daughter. She is not praying for herself. Nothing wrong with that. I don't mean to misunderstand that. But she is praying for someone else. Her daughter. And then she says, my daughter is severely demon-possessed. She says, Lord, my daughter is under the control of your enemy. She is not praying for something frivolous for her daughter. For example, I have two kids in college. I get up every morning and pray one thing for my daughter. Oh God, give my daughter money for college that isn't mine. I pray that every morning. So far, hasn't been answered. Now that's a frivolous prayer. That is not what she does here. Anything at all wrong in this request? She says, God, I don't deserve it. Jesus, I know absolutely who you are. I am not praying for myself, and I'm not praying for frivolity. I'm praying because my daughter is in the clutches of your personal enemy. Now, if somebody comes into my office, sits down, and says, Brother Chris, here's the prayer I'm going to pray. What do you think? Well, I guarantee you my response is going to be as a pastor. Listen, that's great. God will honor that. He will respond to that. Pray it. But watch the response of Jesus. Verse 23. He answered her not a word. She comes to him with an absolutely perfect request. His response is deafening silence. He says nothing. Then his disciples came and urged him, and obviously he must have turned and walked away from her, because it says, saying, send her away, she cries out after us. Obviously, he's even begun to walk away. He has totally ignored her. And I love the disciples. Let me tell you something. If you're having trouble spiritually, you go and read about the disciples. They will make you feel better. These guys just don't ever get it. Their response to her is to say to Jesus, oh, Lord, she's driving us nuts. Get her out of here. He does speak finally in verse 24, but again, not to her. But he answered and said, I was not sent except to the lost house, the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, I got to tell you something. At this point in my heart, if I've come to Jesus Christ with what I think is a perfect request, he has ignored me, he has turned away from me, and his men have begged him to get me out of the vicinity, I'm going to tell you, one or two things are going to be my reaction. I'm going to slump my shoulders in despair, and I'm going to walk off and think, you know, God doesn't do what he says he will. Or I'm going to respond in Jesus Christ in hard, biting anger and say, I thought I could come to you, and obviously I can't, and you have failed me, and all that God says is a lie, and I will not believe anything you ever say again, and walk away. Look at her response. Then she came and worshiped him. That is astounding. She said, help me. Now, for the first time, he actually does respond to her in verse 25 to verse 26. But he answered and said, well, it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. He basically says, well, yeah, you're part of the house, but you're really not part of the family. You're just one of the pet dogs. She said, yes, Lord, but even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered and said to her, a woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed from that very hour. Now, that is an amazing story to me. It is not the norm that we honestly teach in churches. We teach that Jesus Christ immediately responds, but that is not what he does here. He does everything he can to stop her. This is what happens. And I want you to listen to me carefully, because it's the key to your ministry. The truth that God the Father taught her overcame the test that God the Son gave her. Now, obviously, God's taught her some amazing things. When Jesus Christ refuses to even answer, he turns, he walks away from her, she keeps going. Why? Because somewhere God taught her, look, I will not always respond at your moment and at your time, so you need to wait and trust me. So she does, she keeps going. When the disciples try to send her away, obviously God's taught her, don't judge me by the people that serve me. He's obviously taught her that truth. When she finally begins to worship him, when he doesn't even respond to her response to them, she worships him because somewhere she's been taught by God that when I don't do exactly what you think I ought to, you still honor and worship me. And then finally, somewhere he taught her that even though you're not a part of the house of Israel, I still love you and will take care of you. Somehow all that God the Father taught her overcame the test God the Son gave her. Now listen to me carefully. You can go to all the church growth conferences you want to, but the bottom line of whether or not God uses you, listen, is based on whether or not the truths he teaches you, when he tests you, you pass. And he will test you. And the problem with God is the tests are ferocious. In the Old Testament, he took Israel, had a call on them that they would be his people. So he pulls them out of Egypt, he gets them, what does he do? He does all these great miracles. 10 of them. I mean, he just demonstrates his power right and left. He pulls them out, and right before they get out, he drowns the Egyptian army in all that water. Now, they're standing now in Canaan, so they've seen all these miracles. They've seen an Egyptian army annihilated. They're standing here, so God says, get a committee together. Only time you wonder, but God said, get a committee together. At first, obviously, Southern Baptist, because the vote's 10-2, and it's not good. So they go out. They come back. They say, you know, we can't take these guys. They're huge. They're big. They're mammoth. We can't handle it. And what does God do? Does he say, well, I understand. I know it's a little tough. No, sir. What he does is he says, okay, then I'm done. You will stay alive. You will wander in the wilderness. And the call that I had for you will not be enacted in your life because you have failed to trust me. They even try to enact the call themselves after that and wind up failing, and they wander for 40 years until everybody's dead except Joshua and Caleb. God's testing of the truths he gives you will be ferocious and difficult, but you listen to me, that's the key to the ball game. You can be creative all you want to, you can have all the screens and the drama and all the cute things you want to, but if you want God to anoint your life, you're going to have to believe what he tells you, because sooner or later he will test what he teaches you. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 13. I love 1 Samuel, my favorite book in the Bible, 1 and 2 Samuel. But I want you to listen to what God does with Saul. He calls him to be king, and he does this. Number one, in chapter 10, verse 12, it says, is Saul among the prophets? So number one, God says to Saul, I can change you inside. Then number two, in chapter 11, he gives him victory over Jabesh Gilead. So he says, I can conquer any problem you face. And then he gives him the test. So he's taught Saul two things. He says, Saul, I can change you. Number two, there is no enemy I will not conquer for you. Now watch the test that comes, because this is unbelievable. It says in chapter 13, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men. So he's got 3,000 men. Now he's battling the Philistines. Now watch this. Verse 5, it says, the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots. So Philistines have 10 chariots for every one man Saul has. Then it says they have 6,000 horsemen. So they now have two horses for every man he's got, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. So we figure at least they've got the same amount. They've got probably 72,000 people over there. He's got three. I love verse 6. When the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed, well, duh, then the people hid in caves, thickets, rocks, holes, and pits. Yeah, there's your first deacons right there. It's not in Acts. It's in 1 Samuel. I guarantee you these guys are going, we're with you, Saul. Bob, do you know where that cave was? It's kind of like deacons. We're with you, Pastor. Do you know where those resumes were we had from the last search committee? These guys are not walking with him well. And so God's not done with a test. Look in verse 22 of chapter 13. It says, it came about on the day of battle. There was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan. But they were found with Saul and Jonathan, his son. So So here's the bottom line. I've got 3,000 guys, none of whom are glad to be here. I've got 72,000 people I'm facing. They all have weapons. I've got two. And you know what? God asked me to do one thing. He actually doesn't say, Saul, I want you to charge Philistia and wipe them out. He says, I want you to do one thing. I don't want you to offer the sacrifice till Samuel shows up. That's all he asked me to do. Saul can't do that. So he offers the sacrifice. And I want you to listen to what Samuel says to Saul in verse 13. Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now, and listen to this, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. If Saul had not offered the sacrifice and had waited for Samuel, this woman in Matthew 15 would not have said, O Lord, son of David. She would have said, O Lord, son of Saul. Saul was meant to be the one on whom the Messiah's throne would reign. But he can't trust God. And so God removes it and he says, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. He taught him. He said, son, I can change you. I can conquer anything you face. And then he put him in one of the most ferocious tests you could possibly put him and said, you better wait on me. Didn't do it. Stayed alive. Stayed king. But the calling that God had for him was never enacted in his life. See, you need to understand something. Somehow we have this idea sometimes of God that we're in the Qantas Club and he's the president and he offered us this summons. No, sir. You're in the kingdom of God. And the creator of the universe has called you. You better believe what he says. And what he will do is he will teach you truth. And he will test that truth. He said, well, why is he so hard that way? Because everything you do in the ministry, everything you teach the people that you're over will be based on what God has said that they believe or don't believe. I remember I preached a sermon one time, and in the sermon at A&M, we have about 1,200 Aggies. We quit doing evangelism with the Aggies because they never reach the age of accountability. But we have about 1,200 of them and preach a sermon in the message, talk something about not having premarital sex. Got a letter that week, really nice letter, great letter, from a little college student. And she said, I just want you to know, Brother Chris, you're wrong. You know, like that's my idea, premarital sex being wrong. No, I didn't come up with that. I'm a sinner. I'd probably be okay with it, but God came up with that. You're going to have to deal with the one that came up with that. It's not my idea. So she says, you know, I hear your view about premarital sex, but I want you to understand my boyfriend and I are involved sexually, and it has enhanced our relationship. Very nice letter, talked about still they would be coming to church, but that I was wrong in this arena. Now, what's the issue for morality? She has to come to a place, and I'm going to tell you something. I don't care if anybody says sex outside of marriage is fun, but it is not blessed. How do you know that? You have to believe it. Morality. It's actually based on what you believe about what God says. Everything is based there. When I was at Academy Store in Bryan, College Station, sporting goods store, I was standing out. One of my deacons came by and his wife, and I had been out of town, and I had learned she had breast cancer. So I walked up to her, and we were talking, and I was going through my pastoral mode of the ladies that had had that and how they had conquered it. And then she and her husband looked at me and said, well, Brother Chris, we've discovered since that it's way worse than that. It's in the bone, and it's in the liver. Now, you're reduced to one thing when you face that kind of crisis. You've got to believe that God, A, knows what he's doing, B, is in control, C, loves you. And the person that is to lead the people in faith had better believe himself. And so what God does is he will teach you and test you. And if you can't pass the test, he can't use you. Because you can't lead people to do something you're not doing yourself. And here's the really bad part. He will always test you at your point of greatest fear. What's Israel's point of greatest fear? They're in the middle of nowhere. They don't know anything about military tactics. They're scared to death. He tests them there. What's Saul's greatest point of fear? When they come to anoint him king, where is he? He's hiding in the baggage. What's his fear? That he can't be a leader. What does God ask him to do? To be a military warrior? No. To lead the people, to wait on God. He can't do it. This woman, what does he ask her to do? Her greatest fear is the loss of her daughter. You hear me? What God will do is always test you at your point of greatest fear. And understand this. It's always a pop test. And it's for a final grade. Now, that's hard, but it's the way he calls it. I remember my second church, First Baptist Church, New Baden. Now, I'm just going to tell you the honest truth. I had about 110 in Sunday school. I had 30 people that were Benny Hinn as the fourth person of the Trinity Charismatics. I had them over here. I had over here about 30 Jesus was Southern Baptist or he wasn't saved people here. And I promise you, I had about 30 people in the middle who, if I had preached that the virgin birth wasn't true, would have come up to me after the sermon and said, "Brother Chris, that touched my heart deeply." So I basically had whacked out Charismatics, whacked out Southern Baptists, and a bunch of people that just didn't have a clue. Now you can imagine what it is like to pastor that kind of church. No matter what you say, somebody is hacked. You got about 30 that like it, but you got somebody that is hacked. I spent 2.5 years there, and after my first week there, and this is not exaggerated, I did not go a single day without hearing somebody assault me. And here's the tough thing for me. My greatest fear in the ministry was being fired. It was the single greatest fear in my life. And so now here I sat in a church that was a constant buzz of hostility. So much so that I would get so sick, I would dehydrate, that it'd take me to the hospital, shoot me up with some stuff, get fluids back in me. They'd check everything, but I mean the bottom line, and I've never had it since, the bottom line was incredible stress. And so I had a lot of wine sessions with God, and I finally one night was having a very huge wine session, and I was complaining to God, and I was praying those psalms, you know, God grind their children to powder. I mean, there are some great psalms that you can pray when you really want to, and you know, and I was kind of helping God, saying, you know, God, if you don't know who, let me know. I've got some names. And so I was in the middle of one of those wine sessions, and I'm really praying, and I'm just begging God to just wipe them out. And it's one of those nights, and this doesn't always happen, it's one of those nights when God's Spirit just spoke to me and arrested me. As a matter of fact, I remember looking up. It was such an arresting moment. And I'd finished my wine, and the Holy Spirit of God spoke to me and said, "Chris, did I send you there to love them or for them to love you?" I remember stopping and I said, "Well, God, you sent me here to love them." And the Spirit said, "So it really doesn't matter whether they love you or not, does it?" Now, that was a real tough thing for me because it meant two things. Number one, I had to love people that hated me, but the second thing was, I had to love the people and trust God over the people I feared the most in my life. Now, that was a real hard thing for me. And so he, that night later, gave me the 25th Psalm where he said, "I will handle your enemies." 2 days later, one of my worst deacons, as a matter of fact, he was 70 years old, he had started a petition for me to be fired. And this is the truth, because I had gone and gotten corsages for Mother's Day without checking with his wife, who was chairman of the flower committee. So you've pastored in East Texas, that's hard to believe, but that was the deal. So he comes to my house 2 days after this, and he sits down, big tears in his eyes, and he goes, "Look, I've given you a lot of trouble since you've been here, and I want to make a promise to you. I will not give you any more trouble as long as you're pastor." I remember being stunned, and I couldn't believe him. He told me the truth. He never did. I was there about 6 more months. He never did give me any more trouble. I found out later that there was a little old couple that loved me and my wife and my kids, and they'd given all the money for the church. And when she found out he started the petition, she called him, and Christian Love talked to him. I don't care how God did it. I was just glad. But what he did show me is that God really does honor his word, and so I trusted him. And unbeknownst to me, after that, it wasn't 6 months later, he took me, I was broken, put me in a broken church in Midland, Texas. God just blessed enormously, and then he's taking me to Bryan, where God has just done incredible things. But I believe with everything in my heart. I don't think Saul knew it at the time. I don't think Israel knew it at the time. I don't think this woman knew it at the time, and I certainly don't think I knew it at the time. But I think that was my test. And I want you to understand something. He will bring truth to you. You better pass the test He said, it doesn't matter how clever you are. It doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter how winsome you are. It doesn't matter how brilliant you are. What matters is whether or not you trust him. I want you to listen to this verse of scripture. It says, the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him because he believed in his God. That is the key to ministry.